I arrived in the Caribbean with the sun burning gold over the Atlantic, but my eyes weren't on the beaches. They were fixed on the shadows, the ones buried deep in the soil, in bloodlines, in surnames passed down like relics. As a cultural documentarian, I've explored the ruins of plantations, stood on auction blocks weathered by time, and walked with descendants still carrying the weight of forgotten chains. Across Jamaica, Barbados, Saint-Domingue, Trinidad, and Cuba, one truth echoes louder than any tide. Slavery never ended. It evolved. It crept into the economic systems, into color lines, into the very scaffolding of Caribbean society. This journey isn't about guilt or spectacle. It's about understanding how a system built on stolen bodies and broken spirits still shapes land ownership, class division, and identity today. The Caribbean is vibrant and alive, yes, but beneath its beauty is a bruised legacy, one we must reckon with together. Chapter 1. Beneath the Sugar, Mapping the Roots of a System. I stood at the edge of an abandoned sugar estate in St. Anne, Jamaica. The wind carried whispers through the crumbling stone aqueducts, once the arteries of a plantation empire. Moss curled around rusted iron. Remnants of tools once used, not just for agriculture, but for subjugation. It's here, in places like this, that the modern Caribbean was carved into existence. Not in parliaments or palaces, but in fields, auction blocks, and slave ships. To understand the Caribbean today, you must first understand what it was built upon. Between the 15th and 19th centuries, an estimated 12.5 million Africans were taken through the transatlantic slave trade. Over 4 million of those were funneled into the Caribbean basin. The numbers are staggering, but they don't bleed like the stories behind them. For every name recorded in shipping ledgers, thousands more vanished, unnamed, undocumented, erased. Slavery in the Caribbean was not a sideshow to history. It was the economic engine of the Western world. Sugar, coffee, indigo, cotton, molasses, these weren't just exports. They were the lifeblood of European empires, extracted through the destruction of African societies and the mechanization of black flesh. I visited Barbados next, often called the Laboratory of Slavery. British planters there systematized human bondage into precise hierarchies of terror. Their innovations, branding irons, strict plantation codes, economic punishment, would become the blueprint for the rest of the region. I walked the gully trails slaves once used to flee, felt the temperature shift in the limestone dungeons beneath plantation houses. Each site was silent, but it screamed in memory. What began as chains became policy. From Jamaica's brutal Act for Better Order and Government of Slaves in 1788 to the Spanish Código Negro, the system entrenched black suffering into law. The plantation was not just a site of labor, it was a machine of cultural erasure. Names were taken, languages banned, families split, entire cosmologies reduced to shadows. Yet despite this machinery, resistance endured. In Saint-Domingue, which would later become Haiti, I stood on the very soil where enslaved Africans launched the only successful slave revolt in modern history. Led by leaders like Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the revolution didn't just dismantle slavery, it shattered a colonial myth that a black nation could never govern itself, that a people broken could never rise. Haiti's birth was both a miracle and a warning. European powers retaliated economically and diplomatically, ensuring the newly freed nation would suffer under the weight of international isolation and war debt, a burden that still stifles Haiti's economy today. What slavery left behind in the Caribbean is more than scars. It's infrastructure. The plantation grid often determined the layout of towns. Former slaveholding families became modern political and economic dynasties. And perhaps most strikingly, the ownership of land, still heavily centralized in many islands, remains haunted by the unequal distributions of the colonial era. I spoke to an elder in Dominica who pointed out that some families in his village still work on lands they've toiled for generations, but will never own. "We built it," he told me, gesturing to a ridge of green hills. "But it's never belonged to us." The modern Caribbean economy, with its reliance on tourism and imported goods, was designed post-emancipation to prevent black economic independence. The sugar plantations collapsed not because they were no longer profitable, but because slavery was abolished. Freed people were denied fair wages, credit, and land access, forcing many into wage labor for the same plantations they were once bound to. In today's Jamaica, Trinidad, or St. Lucia, wealth is still highly racialized. Light skin is still an advantage in social mobility. The wealthiest families still trace their origins to either European colonists or the merchant class that profited from their trade. It's not coincidence, it's design. Slavery is not just a historical institution, it is the foundation of modern Caribbean society. Its ghosts live in income disparity, in the privatization of land, in the imported food economy, in the undervaluing of Creole languages and African-derived spiritual systems. It lives in how governments are structured, in how beauty is marketed, in who holds power. And as I stood beneath the decaying windmill of a plantation ruin in Martinique, I thought of how casually tourists pass by these places, taking photos of ruins without realizing what they are. The bones beneath, the blood once spilled to grow sugar for European tea tables. The Caribbean is not just a paradise, it is a graveyard. And from that graveyard, a people have risen, still demanding to be heard. Chapter 2. Emancipated but not free. From chains to systems. The emancipation documents of 1834, 1838, 1848, depending on which Caribbean island you stood on, were written in the ink of progress. But for those who had lived under the whip, the ink was invisible. I remember unfolding a reproduction of the British Slavery Abolition Act in a museum in Bridgetown, Barbados. "Freedom," it read. But in reality, what followed was not liberation. It was rebranding. I travelled to Antigua first, where a local historian walked me through what he called the lie of emancipation. The system hadn't crumbled, it had simply evolved. The British government paid millions in reparations, not to the enslaved, but to slaveholders for the loss of their property. The formerly enslaved received nothing. Worse, they were required to serve a forced apprenticeship period under their former masters, laboring for free in exchange for their education in freedom. These were not reparations. They were rehearsals of power. On the sugar estates, I met descendants of both slaves and estate owners. My great-grandfather was born in 1862, decades after abolition, one man told me in St. Kitts, but he still worked the cane fields his whole life for pennies. That's freedom. Land, the cornerstone of generational wealth, was withheld. Freed people were denied plots, denied bank loans, denied equal economic footing. The prime agricultural lands remained in the hands of European-descended elites. New systems of taxation and export tariffs ensured the black population remained dependent on the same plantation economy that had enslaved them. It's a chilling irony. Emancipation was the beginning of poverty, not the end of it. I traced these legacies to Trinidad, where the British imported indentured labourers from India shortly after abolition. It was part of a divide-and-control tactic, pit-freed Africans and newly indentured East Indians against one another, competing for jobs, land and favour. This social engineering still casts shadows today, in subtle ethnic tensions, in political party divisions, in economic class structures. Modern Caribbean inequality doesn't appear in chains. It appears in underfunded schools, in poorly maintained roads, in rural black communities, in tourism zones fenced off from the neighborhoods where hotel staff live. I visited Montego Bay and saw the stark contrast. Gated resorts with foreign investors profiting from black labor and land, while nearby schools begged for textbooks. At a cultural center in Haiti, a griot told me, "Slavery taught us we are less than human. The world has not yet corrected that lie." Haiti, born of revolution, still lives in the economic shadow of the indemnity it was forced to pay France, a sum so large it crippled the nation for over a century. Imagine being forced to pay your oppressor for the crime of escaping oppression. That is not history. It is theft, alive and breathing. Then there is colorism, an offspring of colonial hierarchy. In many islands, lighter skin is still associated with beauty, intelligence, and leadership. It's the legacy of the house slave versus field slave division, where proximity to whiteness determined worth. Today, that same currency plays out in media, politics, even family dynamics. Dark-skinned Caribbean girls still hear that they should stay out of the sun. Boys with African features still face harsher discipline in schools. I interviewed a sociologist in Kingston who told me, "The plantation may be gone, but the plantation logic remains. It remains in who gets loans, who gets hired, who gets to tell the story of the Caribbean on the global stage, who owns the hotels, who works the cleaning shift." But not everything is despair. In the hills of St. Lucia, I sat with a Rastafari elder who shared how his community reclaims African identity through language, diet, and spiritual practice. "They tried to erase us," he said, "but we still chant, still drum, still grow our own food." Across the islands, from Garifuna communities in Belize to the Maroons in Jamaica, descendants of enslaved people are reclaiming ancestral wisdom. In St. Vincent, a grassroots land reform movement is returning farmland to local black families. In Dominica, Afro-Caribbean spirituality is no longer whispered in shame. It's taught in classrooms. And yet, the trauma lingers. Not as a wound, but as a memory etched into the bone. Families that were torn apart. Last names that were not chosen but branded. Languages silenced. Histories omitted. As a documentarian, I've gathered thousands of hours of footage, but nothing captures the truth like silence. The kind I felt in a churchyard in Barbados, built beside a slave burial ground. The kind that hangs in the air when a child asks, "Why don't we own the land we live on?" Freedom without land. Freedom without wealth. Freedom without justice. That is not true emancipation. That is survival. And survival is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of a demand for memory, for dignity, for redress. Chapter 3. Memory, Reckoning, and the Rising Generation. On my final morning in the Caribbean, I stood beneath a ceiba tree in Cap Haïtien, Haiti, its gnarled roots sprawling like a monument carved into the earth. A local historian told me that enslaved Africans once held secret ceremonies here, invoking the spirits of their ancestors and plotting liberation. The tree, now centuries old, carries no plaque, no official marker, and yet it holds memory deeper than any archive. That's the thing about history in the Caribbean. It lives not only in museums or documents, but in land, music, rhythm, and blood. The role of slavery in shaping the Caribbean is not confined to the past. It echoes, evolves, and occasionally erupts. And now, a new generation is learning to name it. In Kingston, I attended a youth forum on reparations and historical justice. One panelist, no older than 19, stood and said, "We inherited trauma, but we also inherited fire. That fire has sparked regional movements demanding not just acknowledgement, but restitution. The Caribbean Community, CARICOM Reparations Commission, established in 2013, has become the political voice of this historical reckoning. With member states like Barbados, St. Vincent, and Grenada pushing for reparative justice from former colonial powers, a blueprint has emerged. Debt cancellation, education programs, cultural return, health initiatives, and land redistribution. Yet reparations are more than a diplomatic agenda. They're a psychological rebalancing. I interviewed a teacher in St. Lucia who explained how her school now incorporates Afro-Caribbean resistance figures into the curriculum. Nanny of the Maroons, Boussa, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, no longer just footnotes. "It's not about blame," she told me. "It's about giving our children back their heroes." At the University of the West Indies, students debate British accountability alongside discussions of black psychology and Creole resistance. Archives are being digitized, oral histories are being recorded, and perhaps most crucially, descendants of enslaved people are controlling the narrative. Diaspora voices, particularly from the UK, Canada, and the US, are amplifying the Caribbean's history on global stages. Podcasts, documentaries, spoken word artists and filmmakers are reframing the region not as a tourist escape, but as a ground zero of resilience. I attended a spoken word showcase in Port of Spain, where one poet shouted, "We come from salt and survival, from whip and womb, from people who never forgot how to sing." That refrain stays with me. Yet the fight for reckoning is uneven. Some governments still shy away from directly addressing slavery's legacies. Statues of colonizers still stand in public squares. Streets still bear the names of enslavers. Textbooks in many Caribbean schools still devote more space to British monarchs than to enslaved Africans who built the nation. But the cracks are widening. In 2020, Barbados announced it would remove Queen Elizabeth II as head of state, a symbolic severance from the colonial legacy. In Jamaica, talks of republicanism have been reignited, driven not just by politics, but by a population increasingly unwilling to celebrate its oppressors. Meanwhile, cultural resistance continues to bloom. Reggae, calypso, and dub still carry messages of historical memory. Rastafari Liberty offers an alternative value system grounded in Afrocentrism and spiritual defiance. Even culinary traditions, from Callaloo to jerk to palau, tell stories of survival, adaptation, and innovation under constraint. I met a Maroon leader in Jamaica's cockpit country who told me, "Our ancestors never stopped resisting. They just changed the weapons." Today, those weapons are pens, microphones, cameras, books, and ballots. But perhaps the most revolutionary act is remembrance. Because to remember slavery not as a closed chapter, but as a living influence, is to challenge the systems it birthed. Education, economics, politics, even self-image, all bear its fingerprints. As I prepare to leave the islands, I reflect on a conversation I had with a Dominican grandmother. We stood outside her wooden home, surrounded by grandchildren, chickens, and the fading hum of evening prayers. "Slavery," she said, "is not just in the past. It's in how we raise our children, in how we heal, in how we still dream of freedom." Her voice, gentle and unshaken, reminded me of what this entire journey has taught me. That the story of slavery in the Caribbean is not only one of brutality, but of survival. Not only of loss, but of legacy. And that legacy demands more than monuments. It demands truth, dignity, equity, and above all, memory.